Student Con location, October 5th, 1964. Dr. Weinberg speaks on the new emphasis in Hebrew.
Our speaker this morning comes to us with a rich and varied background. Dr. Weinberg was born in Germany, where he graduated from the Hebrew Teacher Seminary in Würzburg. He taught at the Jewish School of Hanover until he immigrated to Holland in 1939. After teaching Hebrew in Holland, he later became cultural director of the Hakshara, an organization formed to prepare pioneers for life in Palestine. During the German occupation of Holland, he first lived underground and then in various concentration camps. After the war, he helped to reorganize the Hakshara in Holland. Dr. Weinberg came to this country in 1948 and served as teacher in various congregational schools. In 1961, he received the degree of Doctor of Philosophy from Hebrew Union College in Cincinnati, with major in modern Hebrew literature and minors in Jewish history and Tannaitic literature. That same year, he was appointed to the faculty of Hebrew Union College, where he has since become Director of Hebrew Instruction. We are very pleased to be able to present to you this morning Dr. Werner Weinberg.
First, I want to thank Professor Brown for his words of greeting and introduction. And then I want to say what probably each visitor here feels compelled to say, how beautiful and inspiring your campus is, and how it seems to promote a sense of meditation and of adoration. Me, it made think of the words of the Psalms, which say, in their original language, Hishtachavu ladonai bahadrat kodesh, and to translate it into a different language, worship the Lord in the beauty of holiness. I also want to say, in the way of introduction, that I saw the treatise which Professor Brown wrote at the beginning of this year for the faculty on the value of study Hebrew for Christian theologians, and how very much impressed I was by it. Also, this description was followed by a description of the individual Hebrew courses that are being offered here at your school. If I understand it right, you have 3 hours of biblical Hebrew throughout the senior year, which are augmented by, which seem to me very interesting electives, some which would make a good showing, for example, at the Hebrew Union College in Cincinnati at my school. It will be some time until you can appreciate what I just called the Hadrat Kodesh, the beauty of holiness that lies in the Hebrew language. There are many unholy obstacles, like in all learning and in all beginnings. But with God's help, you will overcome them and experience the great joy of being able to read the Old Testament in the language in which it was first recorded. You may know this from studying other languages. There is no really such a thing as translation altogether. There is at best approximation. And there can be no substitute for reading great literature in the original. This is true of Homer, and this is true of Shakespeare, and this is true of Goethe, and this is certainly true of the Bible. There are only 2 fairly complete studies dealing with the place of Hebrew in institutes of higher learning in this country. Both consist of 2 parts written with some years in between. The first was done by Professor Abraham Katch of New York University with publications in 1940 and 1950. The other by Dr. Judah Lapson of the Hebrew Culture Service Committee of New York, with reports appearing in 1953 and 1958. From these surveys, we see that the study of Hebrew in this country has increased markedly since the Second World War and has steadily been growing since. Lapson brings in his 1958 report the actual catalog listings of Hebrew courses in some 200 American institutes of higher learning. While I do not know whether these 200 schools represent the 1958 total of Hebrew teaching institutions, I assume that they form at least a representative selection. We find that Hebrew is in no way limited to theological seminaries or colleges. Increasingly, Hebrew is being offered at state or municipal universities and colleges. Among the theological schools which offer Hebrew, Protestant ones form by far the largest percentage. Within this group, I found that your own denomination is indeed very well represented. The Concordia Seminary in St. Louis is listed with no less than 11 regular courses and 11 graduate courses in Hebrew, and this with a prerequisite of 12 hours of elementary Hebrew, which I take to be the 9 hours which are obligatory in your senior year here, plus at least 3 hours of one of the electives. Leafing through Lapson's book, we find Hebrew courses offerings at Lutheran theological seminaries in Philadelphia, Thiensville, Wisconsin, Columbia, South Carolina, Dubuque, Iowa, Minneapolis, Moorhead, and St. Paul in Minnesota, respectively. Scanning the course descriptions for relatively new offerings, we are not surprised to find at both theological and general schools courses dealing with the Dead Sea Scrolls, aside from expansions of Semitic departments, which include the new discoveries in Semitic epigraphy, upon which I will come back in a moment. New offerings in modern Hebrew are mostly confined to Jewish theological schools and to general colleges or universities in their liberal arts, humanities, Near East, or language departments. Here and there, we find a Christian theological school beginnings with an approach to teach contemporary spoken Hebrew as a key to the classical texts. Generally, this method seems to be still too experimental as to base on it instructions in the Hebrew instruction in the Hebrew classics. But at the so-called Ulpanim, Jewish-sponsored schools, practically all in Israel, even though we do have some here in the East, where the language is taught by what you may call the army method in a very intensive course, there you see many Christian students. I had, especially in Jerusalem, the impression that the Jesuits, above all, are giving to this method, learning modern Hebrew in order to then approach the classical text more than passing attention. From the few informations provided so far, we can already extract some of the motives for the new emphasis on Hebrew in this country. Chronologically, the first would be the revival of Hebrew as a vehicle of modern life, which you must not think came about only with the founding of the State of Israel, but preceded that founding for at least two generations. Next in time would be the discovery of a Semitic language, which is, you know, by the name of Ugaritic, in the 1930s, a language very, very close to Biblical Hebrew, but its documents being several centuries older than the oldest biblical parts, and this, of course, gave new impetus to Old Testament studies. And finally, the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls, which dramatically almost coincided with the proclamation of the State of Israel, with their historical, archaeological, theological, paleographic, and linguistic implications. These furnish the last great motive for renewed zeal in studying Hebrew. Of the three causes so far cited, the revival of Hebrew as a modern tongue seems really least of all to explain the numerous course offerings in that discipline which are now current at non-Jewish American Institutes of Higher Learning. For let us face it, while we do have a modern language here, while this language does form the key to one of the cultures of the contemporary families of nations, it is only a small nation. Politically and economically of little consequence, and Hebrew is a national language of perhaps 2 to 2.5 maximally million souls. There are many more Finns or Dutch or Turks and much fewer courses in their languages. Even if we add the very practical consideration that the chairs for modern Hebrew and Jewish culture at some universities and colleges are endowed by Jewish individuals and organizations, if we furthermore consider the special interest which both historic and structural linguists take in the unique phenomenon of a language fully revived, even then, the volume of study of Hebrew in our time in this country seems out of proportion to these stimuli. We believe that also factors less obvious are co-responsible for the new emphasis on Hebrew. There are esoteric, perhaps purely religious factors, but there are also more palpable historical ones that have to do with the way Hebrew was studied as a sacred tongue generally, and in this country in particular, and with the way it was reactivated after its long, long dormancy. It is on these three latter reasons, I repeat them, the study of Hebrew generally, the study of Hebrew in this country in particular, and the, what you may call, renaissance of the Hebrew language, that I will be able to shed some light today. The second of these three topics, the Hebrew study in the United States, has been only a small topic in recent research. Very little work has been done on it, and most of the available information is contained in the report I mentioned before by Professor Abraham Katch of New York University in his 1950 book, and also in separate articles by the same author. The beginnings of the study of Hebrew as a language, generally, were unscientific indeed. The Masoretes, Jewish scholars in Palestine and Babylonia in the 6th to 8th, perhaps 9th century AD, were very uncritical in their endeavor to establish the authoritative text of the Hebrew Bible. Their respect of the handed down versions, even though these versions were different, was absolute. They allowed variants to coexist. For example, making one the official version for writing the sacred writings, which means copying, and the other one for the oral scriptural recitation. They continued and raised to permanence obvious scribal errors, omissions, incidentals, like, for example, oversized and undersized letters, and in their main achievement, the vocalization of the originally consonantal text, they were literally and strictly guided by the injunction which you find in Deuteronomy 13:1, quote, "Thou shalt not add thereto." While this is said of the law of God, they referred it also to the script. And as a consequence of it, of this, their vowel signs, as you beginning students of Hebrew know very well, were little dots and lines outside the consonantal graphic word frame, which was sacred and untouchable. The Masoretes would not have considered straightening out obvious orthographical inconsistencies in the Bible itself. For example, writing one word at one place, plene, and the same word at a different or very near, what we call defective, leaving out certain vowel letters. Religiously, and I mean religiously, they counted the sacred letters, pointed them extraneously, and succeeded to an amazing degree in handing down a unified text, as has been confirmed some decade and a half ago by the finding of the much, much older text of the Dead Sea Scrolls. This Masoretic text was scrutinized, what we today would call scientifically, for the first time in the 10th century by Sa'adya, one of Judaism's greatest scholars in Babylonia. His disciples brought the study of the text to Spain, and there, from the 11th to the 13th century, under the influence of Arabic philological studies and this influence of Arabic on Hebrew grammar has never ceased since, there a Hebrew grammar took shape for the first time. Many basic concepts. And again, I refer to the beginning knowledge some of you have. Concepts like the triliteral Hebrew root, which we take absolutely for granted, like the concept of the short and long vowels, the open and closed syllables, and the like, were then formulated for the first time. The school of the Kimchites, there were father Yosef Kimchi and two sons, Moses and David Kimchi, they formed a culmination of the golden age of grammatical study in Spain. And basically, it is their concepts we are working with in normative grammar, Hebrew grammar, still today. In passing, I may mention that in your beautiful library, I did see the grammar of Kimchi among the Hebrew grammars and dictionaries displayed there on the shelves. This is David Kimchi. During the next centuries, the study of grammar in Jewish circles came to a standstill. Reacting to relentless persecution, the Jews turned mystics and pietists. It was the time of the Kabbalah and of pilpulistic Talmud studies. The pursuit of philological study was frowned upon, as was the writing of non-liturgical poetry or the occupation with philosophy. There were Jewish Orthodox circles not too long ago, and maybe some exist still today, who look upon the study of Hebrew grammar as something just short of heresy. The idea is Hebrew is the word of God with, and the language of holiness with which you simply do not tamper in any way. This situation lasted till the scientific study of Hebrew was taken up again much later, and this time by Christian scholars. This happened at the end of the 15th, beginning 16th century, went through Renaissance and Reformation. Hebrew acquired a new status in two respects. One as a classical language along with Greek and Latin, and then as the language of the older part of the Bible, which had gained new importance. Now the individual Christian was encouraged to search on his own for the Word of God. Luther's Old Testament translation is already the result of the new Christian interest in, and especially scholarship of, in Hebrew. The more systematic grammatical study of the language befell to Luther's contemporary, the humanist Reuchlin. From Reuchlin's first little Hebrew grammar, De Rudimentis Hebraicis, there reaches an uninterrupted chain to the great Wilhelm Gesenius and to all the brilliant 19th and 20th century German, Christian, Semiticists, Orientalists, Wellhausen, Delitzsch, König, Kittel, Brockelmann, Sievert, Köhler, Baumgartner, Bauer, Leander, Alt, Kautsch, Bergstraesser, Strack, Kahl, and others, each of whom has left an indelible imprint on Hebrew learning. Naturally, Germany did not have a monopoly on Christian Hebrew scholars, and I might be able to mention British, French, American scholars also, but it is a fact that Germany maintained a lead from Reuchlin on, up to the advent of the Nazis, in Christian Hebrew scholarship. And I wonder if not one of the reasons behind the increase of Christian Hebrew scholarship in this country after the war is a so-called shift of centers of learning from Germany to the United States, just as the center of general Jewish learning shifted from Poland to Israel at that time. Jewish Hebrew linguistic scholarship was not resumed until the beginning of the 19th century by the Haskalah, a Jewish humanist movement which started in the wake of the 18th century European Enlightenment. At about the same time, with the advent of the Reform movement in Germany, there began also again from Jewish side a scientific research in the sacred texts. And now in the 20th century, Christian and Jewish Bible and Hebrew linguistic research have merged. Today, at meetings of biblical, oriental, Semitic, or linguistic learned societies here and abroad, Jewish and Christian scholars meet and read their papers, and their publications appear together in uncounted journals in English, French, German, Spanish, Russian, Dutch, and other languages. At the end of this part of my paper, the scientific study of Hebrew in general, it must be mentioned that in the present interfaith and international array of Hebrew scholarship, Israeli scholars are now well represented. But only a part of their work appears in international journals. Very much of the findings of this enthusiastic and productive new generation of Israeli archaeologists, biblical and Talmudic scholars, historians, Semiticists, and linguists is published in Hebrew only. Much of it is of primary importance to any student of Hebrew, and a reading knowledge of Hebrew is becoming more and more indispensable for any advanced work in Semitics, in biblical, rabbinic, and Near Eastern studies. There lies thus, so far, a double importance in contemporary Hebrew for the student of classical Hebrew text. One, learning at least part of the old language through the new, and second, reading the literature written in Hebrew and dealing with the subject. These facts, besides Hebrew being another modern language, go a long way to explain its increase in American institutes of learning. The conjecture seems in place that modern Hebrew will enjoy increasing esteem also at Christian theological schools. Such a completion of the curriculum would not be surprising in a country where the study of Hebrew has enjoyed a most venerable history. And with this, I come to the second part, and I shall give you a short survey of the history of some of its main points of the learning of Hebrew in this country. We know that the Puritans cherished the idea of a theocratic state on a biblical model, and their respect of the Hebrew language formed a part of this idea. Hebrew played an all-important role in the curriculum of the early universities. At Harvard, freshmen began their studies in Hebrew, and for 1.5 centuries, uninterruptedly, the commencement exercises included an oration in Hebrew. Among the old universities who have an uninterrupted history of teaching Hebrew since their inception are, for example, Yale, Columbia, Dartmouth, Rutgers, Princeton, Johns Hopkins, and many others. A number of them has, you may have seen it, Hebrew lettering or words in their official university seals. President Samuel Johnson of King's College, which is Columbia, found that, quote, "Hebrew is indispensable to a gentleman's education," end quote. Ezra Stiles, well-known president of Yale, was himself a teacher of Hebrew. He is reported to have said that none of his students would be caught dead entering heaven and not understanding the Hebrew Psalms being chanted in current use up there. The end of the 18th century now witnessed just in generally a shift from a religious to a political basis of education. A utilitarian, pragmatic approach replaced the humanist one. Technology and science pushed the classics into the background. Now, Hebrew did not disappear then from the curricula, especially not at the divinity schools, but it did fare worse than Greek and Latin did. Hebrew had only sanctity. But the other classical language had also their practical sides, being instrumental, for example, in the study of modern languages, and providing the terminology for practically all of the sciences. And during the 19th century in this country, when new colleges and state universities were founded, they had, as a rule, no Hebrew courses. And those of the new ones who taught Bible did so in translations. And at some existing universities, Hebrew was shifted to graduate departments. Also, the fact that university presidents were then, as a rule, no longer clergymen contributed to the comparative neglect of Hebrew during that time. And in the first four decades of our century, some universities with a long history of teaching Hebrew discontinued it upon the depletion of an endowment fund or the death or the retirement of perhaps the last professor in that faculty. And then after World War II came the new emphasis on liberal arts and also on languages. And by the time of Sputnik, Israeli Hebrew was well enough established as to rank with the modern languages for which there were given study grants under the National Defense Education Act. And now in the last and perhaps main part of my paper, we want to investigate how the language of Amos and Isaiah came to be considered for the American National Defense Education Act. Hebrew was last spoken as the national language of the Jews up to the time of the Babylonian exile in the 6th century BC. Aramaic had made inroads already before that time. We have a most unique testimony for the beginning of the language change from Hebrew to Aramaic in 2 Kings 18:26, and the almost exact parallel place in Isaiah 36:11. This is the time of King Hezekiah about, and this happening is timed usually at the year 700 BC. The king's deputies are standing on the walls of Jerusalem, and Rav Shakeh, the Assyrian general, is besieging the city and giving his speech to the people that they should give up fighting. And then the king's deputies say, "Speak, I pray thee, to thy servants Aramaic, for we understand it." This was the time when Aramaic had become probably the language of diplomats, and the people spoke only what is called in the Bible Yehudit, Jewish, Hebrew, and they were not supposed to understand what they said. Such a recording of a language, of a shift of language in antiquity is, I believe, unique. After the return from Babylonia, it was Nehemiah who led a most zealous fight for the survival of Hebrew as the language of the people. If you read, for example, Nehemiah chapter 13, verse 24. But once the Near East had become part of the Hellenistic world in the 4th century BC, the fate of Hebrew as a spoken language was sealed. Greek and Aramaic became firmly established. From certain places in the Talmud, we know that even in 200 AD, or about that time, Hebrew was spoken in individual homes and circles, but these were most definitely the exceptions. Significantly, the language of literature remained Hebrew. Witness the late biblical books, written in a period when Aramaic was the spoken language, the Dead Sea Scrolls, the Mishnah, the Palestinian Talmud, most of the Midrash, and the liturgical literature. A few Aramaic pieces in the traditional prayer book again form the exceptions. Later, when Jewish religious literature was written in the vernacular, which to any large degree was a case only in the Arabic world, the important works, for example, Maimonides, were promptly translated into Hebrew. In the non-Arabic lands, Christian Spain, France, Germany, later Poland and Russia, a tremendous religious literature was written, mainly commentaries, codes, and responsa, but exclusively in Hebrew, a rabbinic Hebrew, based on the Neo-Hebrew of the Mishnah and quite removed from classical morphology and syntax. The hybrid languages that had meanwhile developed, that is, Judeo-Arabic, Judeo-Persian, Judeo-Spanish, and especially Judeo-German, which became the mother of Yiddish, these languages were confined to speech, to secular correspondence and folkloristic literature, or to popular religious literature for the unlearned. It seems like a strange coincidence that Hebrew gained a completely new lease on life as a language for the present. At the same time, end of the 18th, beginning of the 19th century, when, as we saw, it began to lose ground being studied as a language of the past. But really, it was the same forces that worked both ways. The same secularism that removed the holy language from the academic curricula in America caused among the young Jews in the ghettos of Poland and Russia a burning interest in the sciences and humanities. Overnight, so to speak, they somehow learned Russian and German and some French and some English and had themselves caught in their classes reading treatises on philosophy or geography in unholy languages hidden in their Talmud folios. And here is the marvelous thing on which no historian really can point his finger. Without any special plan and certainly without any fanfare, there began to appear translations and almost immediately also original articles dealing with world history, with mathematics, physics, with astronomy in Hebrew. Yiddish simply would not do for these subjects. And the turn of the 18th to the 19th century saw already two or three irregularly published Hebrew periodicals. Of course, the expressing was rough. Rabbinic Hebrew was considered unfit to express the great new ideas and inspirations of the new world, and so the writing was very close to that of the Bible, full of quotations and allusions and new concepts cast into awkward circumlocutions. In this flowery style, there appeared the first Hebrew novel already in the middle of the 19th century. Only in the last quarter of the 19th century, mostly through the work of a few certain Hebrew writers, a style was developed that, while basically biblical, constituted a harmonious merger with the Neo-Hebrew of the Mishnah. And one of the most remarkable features of this new form of Hebrew was that it had some kind of natural ability of forming new words for the many new concepts. And by the end of the century, some dedicated and often fanatical individuals began to speak this new literary language. The undisputed father of the newly spoken Hebrew was one Eliezer ben Yehuda, a Russian Jew who emigrated in the 1880s to Palestine and from then on refused to speak a single word to anybody, including his wife, who didn't know a word of Hebrew, except in Hebrew. Fortunately, this man, in addition to being a fanatic, was also a great, an exceptional philologist. He searched for forgotten Hebrew words in the vast areas of all of Hebrew literature. He formed many new words himself, and he began a most ambitious work, a complete lexicon of the Hebrew language in all its incarnations. Begun some 80 years ago, this lexicon was just recently brought to a conclusion by generations of successors. Another of Eliezer ben Yehuda's foundings was the Va'ad HaLashon, the language council which screened all new formings. At the beginning of this century, Hebrew became the language of instruction in the Jewish schools in Palestine, then under Turkish dominion. 1925, during the British mandate, the Hebrew University was founded in Jerusalem. And when the State of Israel came into being, it found a full-fledged national language, the vernacular of a second generation of native speakers. The development of the language is progressing now pretty much like that of any other language, except, I would say, for two things. The large percentage of non-Hebrew-speaking immigrants flowing into the country, and perhaps more important, secondly, the consciousness of the people, and especially of its leaders, that theirs is an ancient, sacred language revived. This is a phenomenon which you would not find with other secular languages. Since 1953, the Academy of the Hebrew Language, a government agency, the successor of the old Language Council, is watching and guiding the development of the language as far as that is possible. The last criterion for accepting or rejecting new forms is, of course, the people itself. I will just try to give you some idea about the process of word forming in modern Hebrew. I would say there are four principal ways in which new words, which are so necessary for the new world, are brought into the present Hebrew spoken in Israel. Number one would be the use of old Hebrew words, like the ones I mentioned Eliezer ben Yehuda searched for, which were either lost, for example, in extra biblical literature, or something else, which were never fully understood in the Bible itself, and there are many such words. To give you one single example for a modern Hebrew word, the modern Hebrew word for electricity is chashmal, a word found in Ezekiel chapter 1, verse 4, and never fully understood. It has something to do with the signs and lights, luminaries, something, sparks in the firmament, which Ezekiel saw in his vision. This word was taken for electricity. Secondly, the second way of taking in new words would be the outright acceptance of foreign or rather international words into Hebrew. For example, radio would be considered by every Israeli as a full Hebrew word, and children would have no idea that it's international. While there are hundreds of such words now at home in modern Hebrew, the sum total of these international words, I would say, is less than in other modern languages due to the watchful eyes of Hebrew purists who did succeed to quite a degree to replace at least some of the international terms by Hebrew ones. For example, the international word auto in some form, automobile, did not become popular in Hebrew and was replaced by the man-made mechonit. Some decades ago, there was a kind of fad to form words that sounded like the foreign term, but if you look closely enough, they were really Hebrew. Just one or two examples. For example, the word for telegraph was rendered in by two Hebrew words, deleg rav, sounding the same, which however means a big jump, and the word for protocol, which in European usage, by the way, means not quite the same as in American usage. It means practically only taking the minutes of a meeting, and so it was taken over in Hebrew by the Hebrew words pratekol, which would mean literally the details of everything. But these formings were maybe a kind of game. They simply did not pass the criterion of popular acceptance, and today it is either the full international term accepted without hesitation or a Hebrew word to replace it and independent of the sound of the international word. Number three, one takes the consonantal root of an international word and casts it into the morphology of the Hebrew verb. One example, the international word telephone became in modern Hebrew a PL, and some of you know what I'm talking about, a PL verb, and you have now in the present tense ani metalfein, in the past tense tilfanti, I telephoned, in the future tense atalfein, I shall telephone. And again, no Hebrew child would have an inkling that this is not a book which might come from a word which might come from the book of Isaiah or somewhere there. The fourth way of forming Hebrew words is, I shall describe like this. These are Hebrew roots put into Hebrew word patterns which had not been used for this root until now anywhere in Hebrew literature. A few examples. One of the old new words formed still by Eliezer ben Yehuda is, for example, iparon, for pencil. Now this word is taken from the old root ayin pe reish, which means lead, the metal lead, to write, and from a general word pattern like the word zikaron, memory. Another example, shapa'at means in Israeli Hebrew, in modern Hebrew, shapa'at, influenza, flu, the illness, comes from the root shin pe ayin, which means to flow, and is formed according to the pattern of the biblical word kadachat, fever, so an illness. A quite recent word, but absolutely accepted in Israel, would be the word shach pale, this comes, which means to mimeograph, which comes from the root kaf pe lamet, which means to double, or the adjective double, and an almost disappeared and forgotten conjugation. In Aramaic, we have it more than Hebrew, called the shif el, an intensive verb pattern. This fourth system, I repeat, Hebrew roots cast into Hebrew patterns in which this root was not used heretofore, is of the four systems I have mentioned by far the most fertile one and has yielded thousands and ten thousands of new words. During the last three generations, Hebrew literature had a chance to catch up with the events. Practically all the world's literature from Homer to the latest American bestseller has been translated into Hebrew. Hosts of original Hebrew writers, journalists, playwrights, novelists, poets are being published, and more than a few have been translated into other languages. The bookstores and newspaper stands in Tel Aviv and in an Israeli city, about every tenth shop in every street is a bookstore. You can buy half a dozen daily newspapers, in addition to dozens of weeklies and monthlies, learned and unlearned journals, comic books, and girly magazines, all in Hebrew. There have been speculations whether an Old Testament personality reincarnated into an Israeli town would understand the language. I do not know for sure. No doubt he would have great trouble with teenage slang. I mean Hebrew teenage slang. With certain idioms, colloquialisms, foreignisms, also with professional jargon, with certain substandard usages that are full of phonological and morphological marvels in the eye of the normative grammarian. Still, if our sounds are still their sounds, a thing we will never know for sure, I think the Old Testament personality might understand most of Hebrew, of Israeli Hebrew, certainly more so than Alfred the Great or even Geoffrey Chaucer would understand, say, American English. The reason for this rare linguistic phenomenon is that the language lay dormant since antiquity, and that the reborn Hebrew was guided from its inception. But beyond this, that it is being spoken by a populace which remains intensely aware of its heritage. Most Israelis know large portions of the Hebrew Bible by heart. It is taught that way in the schools, even in the lower grades. There is a living, immediate relationship between the two strata of the language, much more so than, for example, between classical and modern Greek, or between Latin and Italian. Here lies perhaps the main reason for the new emphasis on Hebrew. While in the course of a general turn toward the humanities and religion, perhaps initially aided by a feeling of sympathy with Jewish suffering in World War II, Hebrew gained new ground as a classic as well as a modern language. The most remarkable thing about it may well be this linguistic bridging of the millennia. Last summer, when I went with my 10-year-old niece in Israel over her Bible lesson, I wanted to explain to her difficult words by root and class and conjugation, but she was impatient about that. Israeli youngsters are as cool taught Hebrew grammar as American ones are, not only taught Hebrew grammar, but taught English grammar. But more remarkable than this, she did not need, in most cases, my analysis at all. Now, I'm speaking about words and forms which are not likely to appear in daily conversation. Yet the understanding was usually immediate. These words, in her understanding, were definitely from a different layer of the language, but they were most definitely of her language. We have said that the student of the Old Testament in this country may be aided by modern Hebrew in two ways. One, he could learn much of classic Hebrew the modern way through the revived modern spoken language. Secondly, a reading knowledge of modern Hebrew would open to him vast areas of scholarly writings in his field. To this we may now add that the feel of the language that comes with a native or near-native knowledge of modern Hebrew may open to us gates of direct and immediate understanding to places in the Old Testament that have been closed for centuries. I want to conclude by congratulating you on your fine Hebrew program here at Concordia Senior College, and by wishing you much reward from your Hebrew and your other studies.
For your many kind words and for your interesting remarks and the background which you have given us into our own program. Dr. Weinberg has also graciously consented to make himself available in the student lounge this afternoon beginning at 1:30, and all of you who are free during that hour are urged and invited to attend. We also would like to recognize the number of visitors that we have with us this morning from Huntington College, from the Crozier House of Studies, from North Manchester College. We hope the session has been as interesting for you as it has for us, and we hope also you will be able to make this afternoon's meeting. The convocation is adjourned.